At the mention of kidnapping, most people's first thoughts are of cases where someone's held for ransom money. The West African Republic of Mali, a new stronghold of Al-Qaeda, is said to be currently financing terrorism with an estimated $9 million obtained in the past decade from kidnappings for ransom. There are many different motives for kidnapping, though, and the practice is undoubtedly as old as humanity itself. Abductions have led people into slavery, including countless kidnappings of West Africans during the Atlantic slave trading of the 16th to 19th centuries. Warring factions have taken prisoners, including concubines and children, for political leverage or simply as a show of power. For instance, since 1986, Joseph Kony, leader of the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, has taken over 50,000 children as sex slaves and child soldiers. Today, human trafficking networks for forced labor or the sex trade are still serious criminal enterprises. And especially in developed countries, kidnappings of children by non-custodial parents are far more common than any other type of abduction. A motive is often an important consideration in forensic cases because the motive can lead investigators to likely suspects. By following the trail of evidence, whether at an abduction scene or by studying communications made between the hostage takers and those they contact, police may be able to hone in on the criminals involved or the likely location where victims are being held. But sometimes, no matter how much law enforcement studies a situation and tries to negotiate with the perpetrators, kidnappings do not always resolve without bloodshed or death. That goes for victims, kidnappers, or even law enforcement. Let's look at some historical and modern examples. 3 years after World War II ended, a Jewish homeland was founded as the modern state of Israel. The territory selected for Israel's establishment was then Palestine and controlled by Great Britain by a post-World War I mandate. Problems this decision created have been a source of ongoing conflict between the Israeli and Palestinian people even to this day. Israeli-Palestinian hostility has spawned numerous terrorist organizations, including one known as Black September, formed in 1970. One of their most notorious acts was a mass kidnapping carried out in 1972 during the Summer Olympics in Munich, Germany. Now, 1972 was the first time the Olympic Games were held in Germany since 1936, when the Nazis were in power. Hitler wanted to use the Berlin Olympics as an attempted show of Aryan white superiority. By the way, the African-American athlete Jesse Owens took 4 gold medals in Berlin, but I digress. Anyway, the Germans dubbed the 1972 Summer Olympics the Happy Games and approached the event in a welcoming and relaxed manner, which some, including the head of the Israeli delegation, thought a little too lackadaisical, given the ongoing tensions in the Middle East and the deep wounds the German Holocaust had caused the Jewish people, if not the entire world. On September 5th, the 10th day of the Games, at approximately 4:30 in the morning, 8 Palestinian members of the Black September group, dressed in tracksuits and carrying duffel bags containing assault rifles, handguns, and grenades, climbed a 6-foot fence, unwittingly aided by some Canadian athletes, and they entered the Olympic Village compound. Now, most of the Israelis were housed on the first floor of a small building. The terrorists entered apartment 1, where 5 Israeli coaches and officials were housed. One of those men was shot, taken hostage, and ordered to escort the captors through the building to find more Israelis. The initial hostage bypassed apartment 2, where sharpshooters, a racewalker, and the delegation leader were sleeping. The hostage told the attackers those in apartment 2 were not Israelis, leading them instead to apartment 3, where 6 wrestlers and weightlifters were staying. Forensic analysts suspect the hostage thought those bulky athletes might be better able to overpower the terrorists than the guys in apartment 2. The 6 sleeping men in the 3rd apartment were rounded up and made to return with their captors to the 1st apartment. Once there, the hostages began to put up a fight, and 2 were shot and killed by the Palestinians. One body was thrown out the front door of the apartment, to show authorities the captors were serious. And the other dead hostage was left on the floor of apartment one with the remaining nine Israeli captives who had been bound and then tied together. The commotion awoke others nearby, including the men in apartment two, and several other Israelis were able to escape the building without capture. Next, the Palestinians dropped a list of demands out the apartment window. They wanted the release of 234 prisoners in Israel's custody, plus the release of two German founders of a militant neo-Nazi group, the Red Army Faction, and all by 9 o'clock that same morning. Among the most striking things about this kidnapping was the real-time media coverage it carried all over the world, beginning within just about a half an hour of the initial attack. I remember images of German police snipers dressed in tracksuits climbing up the building where the hostages were held, and terrorists in ski masks on the balconies. If you're around my age or older and from the U.S., you probably recall ABC Olympic broadcaster Jim McKay narrating live coverage of the disaster. Now, this technological issue created an additional problem for the tense situation. The Palestinian terrorists were also watching everything unfold on TV in the apartment where they were holding the hostages. We've all seen television or movie dramas in which hostage negotiators frantically move officers into place, deciding what to tell the captors and what to hold close to the vest. But with that amount of media coverage, the Munich events were completely out in the open. Reporters and their cameras were, in a sense, communicating directly with the hostages and terrorists, which had the potential to circumvent the authorities. This was an extremely dangerous situation. Now, Israel was unwilling to negotiate with the terrorists, fearing further attacks if they did. So this put Germany in a really difficult position because all the hostages were Jewish, and we all know the history there. The Germans offered unlimited money and even to trade prominent Germans for the captives, but the Palestinians refused. One of the keys in hostage situations is to buy time so that authorities can figure out the best plan, learn more about the background of the terrorists, which can allow more effective dialogue. Negotiators were first able to push the deadline until noon and then got three more extensions throughout that day, telling the captors they were considering their demands. But with all the cameras focused on German police moving into position and sportscaster Jim McKay giving blow-by-blow descriptions of the events, by 5 p.m., the day of the kidnapping, the Palestinians refused any further delay. At 6 o'clock, the terrorists demanded to be flown to Cairo, Egypt. So German authorities agreed to transport the Palestinians and their hostages to a military airbase outside Munich on two helicopters, followed by a third helicopter of German officials. Authorities told the terrorists they could board a Cairo-bound Boeing 727 at the airstrip, but in reality, the Germans were planning an ambush. They had snipers positioned when the helicopters landed at the base at approximately 10:30 that night. Now, when two terrorists examined the waiting plane on the airstrip and found no flight crew, they realized things were not going as they had demanded. As they ran back to the helicopter, one of the ambush snipers started shooting, wounding one of the Palestinians. Sharpshooters then opened fire and killed two other kidnappers that were guarding the helicopter pilots, allowing the pilots to run to safety. But the hostages were still bound and unable to get away. The remaining terrorists sought cover and returned fire, shooting out several airport spotlights. And in that partial darkness, a standoff began. By around midnight, the Germans were able to get an armed personnel carriers onto the airbase, and forensic analysts believe the terrorists probably realized they were trapped at that point. So at 12:04, a kidnapper opened fire on the four hostages in one of the helicopters with an assault rifle and then threw in a hand grenade, incinerating the chopper and everybody in it. Then, when the terrorists turned to the second helicopter, where the five remaining hostages were located, they were strafed with gunfire and killed. By 1:30 a.m., the battle ended with five members of the Black September terrorist group dead and three captured. One German policeman also lost his life. all of the Israeli captives were dead. I can still vividly remember Jim McKay's broadcast, which was in part, quote, "Our worst fears have been realized tonight. They're all gone." In the forensic investigation that followed, tooth marks were found on the ropes that bound the men in the second helicopter, indicating how desperately they were trying to release themselves and each other. Autopsies on some of the victims in the burned helicopter were problematic because their bodies were so charred. But at least one of them survived the shooting because he had soot in his airways, showing he died of smoke inhalation. But forensic analyses don't consist only of physical evidence. It was later discovered that before the start of the games, three of the Black September members had managed to get jobs in the Olympic compound to gain familiarity with the location. Now, that might also render them more familiar to witnesses, so their presence wouldn't initially raise alarm. Numerous sources have also alleged that neo-Nazis operating in Germany aided the Black September group, and that's why the Palestinians asked for the release of two German neo-Nazi prisoners among the ransom demands. Now, scholars have debated the relationship of the Black September group to the larger Palestinian Liberation Organization, commonly known as the PLO, or its Fatah branch controlled by Yasser Arafat back then. But 3 days after the Munich attack, 10 PLO bases were bombed by Israeli airstrikes in Syria and Lebanon, killing an estimated 200 people. A little over 6 weeks later, PLO terrorists hijacked a Lufthansa flight bound for Frankfurt and demanded the release of the three surviving Munich kidnappers. German authorities immediately complied, and those terrorists have never been brought to justice. The following April, members of Israel's Mossad intelligence and the Israeli army stormed an apartment building in Beirut, Lebanon, killing three senior PLO members in retaliation for the Olympic executions the year before. In 2012, as the 40th anniversary of the Munich massacre approached, the German magazine Der Spiegel published a series of articles summarizing what they've learned from a comprehensive analysis of formerly classified government documents that are related to the incident. Now, the reporters allege that German authorities ignored clear warnings of the Munich attack, even from one of their own embassy personnel. That person reported about 3 weeks prior to the kidnapping, quote, "An incident would be staged from the Palestinian side during the Olympic Games in Munich," end quote. German police were also aware of an article that ran 3 days before the kidnapping in an Italian magazine about a, quote, "sensational act during the Olympic Games, end quote. They knew that was being planned by the Black September organization. The critical analysis also points to documentation that German officials intentionally covered up many mistakes they made during the hostage negotiations and the ambush. Mistakes involving everything from erroneous assumptions about the number of kidnappers to inadequate numbers, preparation, and weapons of their German snipers. The German government has never publicly acknowledged connections between any German citizen and the Black September group. However, Der Spiegel cites a 1973 final police report on the Munich massacre as definitively linking German neo-Nazi criminals to the Munich kidnappers. Now, this connection was made through a forensic comparison between weapons found on two German neo-Nazis arrested in October of 1972 and those used by the Olympic hostage takers. Specifically, the grenades the neo-Nazis had were made in Belgium with Swedish explosives and had been manufactured for use in Saudi Arabia. Now, those rare grenades were identical to the ones used to blow up the helicopter in the Munich massacre. The arrested neo-Nazis were also carrying a threatening letter to the Munich judge involved in the ongoing legal investigation of the Olympic incident. But most shocking, at least to me, was Der Spiegel's allegation, based on the declassified documents, that after the kidnapping, German officials maintained both secret and blatant diplomatic contacts with the masterminds behind the Munich massacre. Within 6 months after the Olympics, the German authorities were attempting to appease the Palestinians in order to prevent any further attacks on German soil. Allegedly, even the BKA which is the German equivalent of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, was involved in these secret meetings. In late 1972, a senior German foreign ministry official actually sought out the PLO to broker that the Palestinians refrain from any attacks on West Germany so that good relationships, including, of course, German oil supplies from the Middle East, be maintained. Yasser Arafat, then leader of the PLO, agreed in early 1973 to abide by Germany's request if they would let him install a Palestinian envoy in Bonn. Amazingly, the man Arafat sent, and who remained in Germany until 2005, Abdallah Frangi, had been knowingly and directly involved in the Munich massacre. The Black September kidnappers had phoned him several times during the day of the Olympic killings. Although German authorities have opened warrants out for the arrest of the three remaining Munich kidnappers, one of whom has appeared in film documentaries, but two of whom are thought to be dead, Der Spiegel found no evidence that German officials have ever actually pursued them. Now, when kidnapping is for ransom of a financial rather than political nature, the wealthy are obvious targets. So let's examine a kidnapping for money. In 1957, Fortune magazine published its first ever list of the richest people in the world. Any idea who they named the wealthiest man in the world that year? This guy had a net worth estimated at between $700 million and $1 billion U.S. dollars, and that's 1957 dollars. Would it help if I told you the source of that wealth was oil? J. Paul Getty, founder of the Getty Oil Company, got his start in his father's oil fields in Oklahoma in the early 1900s. Despite his riches, he was a known tightwad, famously installing a payphone in his mansion for guests. Among J. Paul Getty's five sons from his many wives was Eugene Paul Getty, who later changed his name to John Paul Getty, making him J. Paul Getty Jr. Now, after he married and had a son, who would be John Paul Getty III, Jr. was sent to Italy to run the Italian branch of Getty Oil, where he and his wife had three more children. Jr. claimed he wasn't cut out for the oil business. He was a drug and alcohol abuser, as well as a womanizer. When the couple ultimately divorced, J. Paul Getty Jr. took up with a second wife, moved to England, and was subsequently disinherited by his wealthy father for being a hippie and an embarrassment to the family. And this wasn't the first time Jr. had disappointed his daddy. In fact, from a very early age, the senior Getty would return letters his young son sent him with any misspellings underlined and corrected. Now, Jr.'s son, J. Paul Getty III, who went by the name Paul, was a partier like his father. After his parents divorced, Paul stayed in Italy with his mother, but was expelled from school by age 15. The boy had long, red, curly hair, was a known drug abuser, cavorted with older women, and had even posed nude in a magazine. In January of 1973, he was arrested for throwing a Molotov cocktail at an anti-fascist demonstration, but officials dropped the charges. And then, on July 10, 1973, at age 16, J. Paul Getty III was kidnapped in Rome. His captors called Paul's mother, and they demanded $17 million in ransom. Now, she didn't have that kind of money. And because her ex-husband was disinherited, J. Paul Getty Jr. couldn't afford the ransom either. The estranged couple turned to Paul's grandfather, the original J. Paul Getty. And his reply was, quote, "I have 14 grandchildren. If I pay one penny now, I'll have 14 kidnapped grandchildren." The older Getty also wondered if the entire thing wasn't a hoax contrived by his grandson to extort money. The captive Paul sent a pleading letter to his mother, saying he was chained to a stake in a mountain cave and was being tortured. Paul believed he would be killed if his mother or his family didn't pay up. After months with no resolution, the kidnappers, members of the Calabrian Mafia, reduced the ransom down to $3 million, but still it was not paid. In November, 4 months after the kidnapping, a newspaper in Rome received a package containing a decomposing right ear. A postal strike had delayed the delivery by nearly 3 weeks. A note with the body part indicated the ear belonged to Paul, and if the kidnappers didn't receive the money within 10 days, a deadline that was already passed, the other ear would be sent. Quote, in other words, he will arrive in little pieces. Authorities wondered if the ear was really Paul's, or could have maybe been removed from a corpse. While in 1973 was prior to the advent of DNA technology for identification, but blood typing could have been used to show consistency or lack thereof between Paul's blood proteins and the discovered ear. The success of such tests would have depended largely on the state of decomposition. It's also possible that if an ear print, yes, you heard right, an ear print, for some reason was on record for J. Paul Getty III, it could have been compared to the ear in the package, again, depending on how intact its features were and its state of preservation. Rarely, ear prints can be used in forensic science in much the same way as fingerprints. Although the first prosecution using ear prints wasn't made until 1998 in England. During a 2-year data collection period, as part of an effort to create an ear print database, UK authorities detected about 100 ear prints of forensic value at crime scenes they investigated. The study found that even identical twins have distinguishable ear prints. Although it's not widely used or universally accepted, ear biometrics continue to be studied in forensics. Though in the Getty case, the most compelling evidence that the ear in question belonged to Paul was the presence of a lock of long, curly red hair that accompanied it. After another newspaper soon received photos of Paul's wounds, his grandfather finally agreed to pay $2.2 million. True to his frugality, that's the maximum amount his accountant said would be tax deductible. The balance of the ransom Paul's captors demanded was loaned by the senior Getty to his son, Junior, at 4% interest. On December 15th, over 5 months after the kidnapping, Paul was finally released. He was found bruised and bandaged near an abandoned gas station in Calabria, Italy, in a rainstorm. Now, the investigation led to the arrest of 9 men, but only 2 of the lower-level gang members were ever convicted and imprisoned, and most of the ransom money was never found. After his recovery, Paul's mother had him call his grandfather to thank him for financing his return, but J. Paul Getty Sr. wouldn't even come to the phone. Paul went on to a life of drugs and alcohol, and as a result, suffered a massive stroke at the age of only 24. He spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair and died at age 54 in 2011. There have been many notable kidnappings of children for ransom. The very word kidnapping, coined in the late 17th century, refers to the nabbing of kids. The 1920s and 30s saw a whole rash of child abductions in the United States and elsewhere. The famous snatching of the infant son of American aviator Charles Lindbergh prompted the Federal Kidnapping Act of 1932, but that hasn't stopped criminals from grabbing kids from homes and even newborns in hospitals. 2 cases that made news during the summer of 2012 illustrate how today's technology is solving and even thwarting hospital abductions of infants. In July of 2012, a woman was sentenced to 12 years in prison for stealing a baby from a New York hospital in 1987 and raising that baby girl as her own. The case came to light because in 2010, the 23-year-old kidnapping victim needed to get a birth certificate, ironically, because she was pregnant herself and was unable to find a birth certificate in her name. She got suspicious and reached out to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a group I've interacted with as part of my work with the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. A DNA testing proved the young woman was actually the baby girl who had been abducted from the hospital 23 years prior. The kidnapper claimed 2 stillbirths in the late 1980s prompted her to steal the baby. The second case happened in August of 2012, when a woman disguised herself as a nurse and attempted to steal a baby from a California hospital in a tote bag, allegedly to try to win her estranged husband back by claiming she had borne him a child. High-tech security methods now in place in most hospitals, at least across the U.S., thwarted that crime. The hospitals place a sensor on the baby's wrist or ankle that monitors the infant's movements throughout the hospital. if the baby's moved to a part of the hospital where he or she doesn't belong, or if the sensor's tampered with, an alarm goes off and automatically locks down the exit doors until authorities can investigate. But once a child goes home, the hospital security ends. In November of 2012, a Chicago woman kidnapped a one-month-old infant from a neighbor's home. This time, the unbelievable motive was to go to court and purport the baby as the child of her boyfriend who had been arrested on drug charges. The kidnapper figured that the judge would be more lenient in sentencing her man after hearing the convict was a father. This time, simple but effective, good old police legwork solved the case. While they were canvassing the neighborhood the morning after the abduction, officers heard muffled cries, and they found that baby girl in the trash where the kidnapper had put her once the story of the missing child had gone public. Now, in addition to infant abductions, we've all heard of horrific cases in which a mother's actually cut open in an attempt to steal her unborn child. In October of 2012, a woman visited a Brazilian clinic because she thought she was pregnant. After finding out her belly bulge was actually a tumor and not a baby, she was afraid her husband was going to leave her. So the woman returned to the clinic later and lured a pregnant woman back to her home under the ruse of giving the visitor some baby clothes. Once at her home, the kidnapper knocked the pregnant woman unconscious and cut the 37-week fetus out of her uterus. She left the victim for dead and proceeded to parade the new baby in the street, telling neighbors it was hers. They didn't buy her story and stormed the woman's house and found the real mother in a pool of blood on the bedroom floor, and they called police. Later, scene investigators found a wooden cutting board which had been used to beat and disable the mother, and also found the razor blade that was used to cut her belly open. Now, if the situation hadn't been so obvious, DNA testing would have certainly resolved their relationships. Luckily, the case did have a happy ending for both the mother and child, as they both survived the attack. Our last case in this lecture is the August 9, 1987 abduction of 21-year-old Paula Beverly Davis from Kansas City, Missouri. It involves an entirely different motive. Now, Paula had a 1-year-old son and was employed as a clerk at a local store. But she was also alleged to be involved in prostitution and had a drug problem. When she didn't come home one night, her roommate called Paula's mother at 3 a.m. saying she had last seen Paula earlier that evening at a truck stop along Interstate 70 just outside of Kansas City. Now, Mrs. Beverly contacted police and gave them all the details she could think of about her daughter, including that she stood 5 feet 5 inches, weighed 125 pounds, was Caucasian, had brown hair and brown eyes. Mrs. Beverly also described the two tattoos on Paula's chest, a unicorn and a rose. Authorities reminded Mrs. Beverly that Paula was an adult and may have simply disappeared of her own volition. But her family just didn't believe Paula would do that. The day after Paula disappeared, the recently deceased and nearly nude body of a young white female with brown hair and eyes was found along Interstate 70, but 600 miles or a 9-hour drive east of Kansas City in Montgomery County, Ohio, about an hour north of where I live. Now, that was the year after I began my forensic consulting with the Montgomery County Coroner's Office, but this wasn't an anthropology case. The body wasn't skeletonized, there was no bony trauma, so I wasn't directly involved. The pathologist determined, I believe by analyzing the vitreous fluid from the woman's eyes, that she had been dead about 14 hours. They did a thorough autopsy, and the cause of death was ruled as strangulation by ligature. But when no identification was made, the woman's body was soon buried in a cemetery in Dayton, Ohio. Now, for over 2 decades, although leads were explored, the identity of the young woman was not known. In the spring of 2009, though, officials from the Montgomery County Coroner's Office entered all of the deceased's pertinent information into the brand new National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, otherwise known as NAMIS. That fall, when Paula Beverly Davis's sister, Stephanie Beverly Clack, whom I've met, heard about a public service announcement regarding this new technology to resolve cold ID cases, she went to the NAMIS website. All Stephanie entered into the database's search function was that the missing person was a white female, age 21, and then 10 suggested possibilities popped up. The first 9 were clearly not her sister, but after just a half an hour on the system, Stephanie found the 10th possible match listed was that of a woman found on August 10th of 1987, the day after her sister's disappearance, with brown hair, brown eyes, and 2 tattoos on her chest, a unicorn and a rose. Stephanie knew she'd found her sister. Now, you might wonder how on earth those cases weren't connected sooner. But in those days, we just didn't have the same kind of computerized databases we have today. But within 2 months, DNA testing from her family was compared to DNA from tissues retained by the Montgomery County Coroner's Office, and the victim's identity was confirmed. As for who abducted Paula Davis, authorities now believe convicted serial killer Lorenzo Gilliard, also known as the Kansas City Strangler, is responsible for her kidnapping and murder, although at this point he's yet to be charged with Paula's untimely death.